Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
Today's episode is sponsored by HP, the leader in world's most secure and manageable PCs. Learn about HP's Healthcare Edition products at hp.com/go/healthcare/US. And for this episode, the news you can use, I'm delighted to be joined again by Dr. Craig Joseph. Craig, thanks for joining me.
It is my pleasure. I'm so excited to be here.
So, lots of things going on, lots of things that we've got to talk about. Let's kick it right off. Talk about that Wall Street Journal that talked about moving away from the randomized control study and using all of this data. We don't need to do randomized controlled studies anymore. We could just aggregate all the data and we've got ready-made trials. What do you think?
Well, I do think it's a step in the right direction, right? And that's part of the problem, a significant part of the problem of making medical advances is finding patients. So it's easy to find for a randomized, and I guess we should probably just talk about what is a randomized controlled study, right? So that's when you have a group of people who you know have a medical problem or something that you're working on, and to see if you're going to any medication or other therapy that you're trying to test, you need to have another group of patients who don't have that problem to see if that if you're helping or hurting or making a change. Yes.
If I may, I'd Please. Like to give a practical version of a randomized controlled study that I did at home, and it was between Coke and Pepsi. And I had heard repeatedly that Coke out of the glass bottle tasted better. So I essentially presented Coke to the family. They didn't know which it came from and asked them to determine which was the best. And I proved that Coke tastes exactly the same whether it comes out of a can or a bottle. And I did that by concealing that so that nobody knew who had the glass bottled Coke versus the non-glass bottled Coke. And I actually reran the experiment, which is essentially that crossover study where you redo it and expose people to a different mechanism.
I like that. I think that was a much better explanation than I was going down.
Trying to simplify things. So we've got this standard that's been around for a long time, right?
Yeah, it takes a long time. You've got to find people. Clearly, electronic health records don't record what I would call pop, what you might call soda preferences. And so hence, for your study, they would be useless. I think we can, agree on that. However, the electronic health record is very good at recording lots and lots and lots of discrete data, some of which is pristine and recorded appropriately and some of which is not.
Right.
And then now you have lots of patients and you can maybe go back and say, hey, medication A, which we started using 10 years ago, we started using on patients with high blood pressure. And we have lots of patients in our electronic health record nationally or internationally with high blood pressure. Only a small percentage of them have been on this medication A. Maybe we could compare similar groups of patients with hypertension who have been on this medication and who have not been on this medication and see if there were if there's anything we could learn. Did the medication help as much as we thought it did? Further, I guess you could take some of that information that's in there and look for trends that an individual physician or individual group of physicians may not have seen. But when you step back and are looking at millions and millions of lives over many years, you can see trends that might not have been picked up on smaller groups, right? Of smaller groups of patients. So if you've got 1,000 patients, that's one thing. If you have a million, that's a completely different thing.
And that's absolutely true. You see those, but doesn't that just show correlation? We don't get to causation with that. So we see a correlation between people that drink pop and those that go to bed early in the evening, and suddenly we've got an association, but that's not right. It's just a correlation versus an actual cause for those two separate events.
That's absolutely true. And I don't think that our technology is going to help us too much this case, right? All it can do is show that correlation. And I will agree. Normally, I like to disagree with you because I find it fun. But you're right. Correlation does not necessarily mean correlation. You know, I'll tell you from my real world experience a million years ago as a pediatrician, some study came out, and I remember it was on the Today Show, so I knew it was real. And the study was that if you put a light on, and if there was a light, a night light on in your small child's bedroom, that child a few years later had a higher risk of vision problems, of needing glasses. Do you recall this study? Yeah. So this was a study that came out on the Today Show. Maybe it was published somewhere else, but that's where I heard about it.
That's where you heard it.
Yeah. And lots of patients came in and our parents came in and said, you know, we're getting rid of the nightlight because clearly if there's a nightlight, we know that it's higher risk for our kids. And I'm like, okay, get rid of the nightlight. After some more, so there was some correlation there, and one presumed there was causation. After some more studies, what they actually showed when they looked at more data, Nick, was that, there's actually a correlation between adults, aka parents who have bad vision, and those parents needing a nightlight when they go into their kids' room.
Using the nightlight for themselves.
Yeah. And so we already know that if the parents are wearing glasses, that the kids much more likely to need glasses. I mean, that's
right.
We know that those run that kind of a problem runs in families. So actually, this study showed nothing except it made a bunch of parents turn off their nightlights for a while and maybe.
No, I disagree. I don't think it did show nothing. I think it showed exactly that correlation, which was important. The problem was that the raw analysis of the data failed to take account of that underlying causative element. But that's the beauty of this. So I think that's where I see the value is. You get all this and we see the correlations, but what we can't do is allow for those correlations to be pushed out into the media and, oh my goodness, drink coffee, you're going to live longer. Drink coffee, you're going to live less long, shorter. That's where I struggle with this, is that people pick up on these correlations and then they're positioned as, you know, actual facts. And I think the randomized controlled study remains a central tenet to sort of proving this out and getting to the bottom of some of those things. So maybe we'll have more information to sort of dig down into, but we're not going to get quicker answers.
I think that's true. And this study might have been, so clearly, you know, as you said, they weren't looking, these original researchers on the Today Show, weren't looking, and I kid, I'm not sure where they presented this, but weren't looking at the parents' health status.
No,
right?
Of course.
But yeah. We didn't have electronic health records back then, but whenever this was, the 90s, or at least they weren't very popular. Now that information would be much more, much easier to obtain with an EHR.
Right.
And so, you know, if there were some concerns or questions about, did we look at this or can we go back and look at that? You can. If you're on paper, it's much more difficult, if not impossible.
Fantastic. All right. So speaking of electronic health records, I think folks probably saw the article that was posted. It was an opinion piece by Tommy Thompson, who essentially, if I can try and summarize it quickly, we should not support any kind of sharing of data through the electronic health record because that would damage Epic's intellectual property and Madison County, City, Wisconsin State's economic viability because it would impact all the jobs. That, of course, tweaked me a little bit.
It did.
I enjoyed
your tweakage.
That position just a little bit of a struggle for me to understand. I do respect the challenge of intellectual property, but what we're talking about here is patient data. And I think most people agree that patients in control of their data and able to access it improves healthcare outcomes. Can we generally agree on that, do you think, or is there even disagreement on that?
I won't. Again, I like to disagree with you. I will not. In this case, I think that if patients have access to their data, only good things come from that.
Right.
That So I don't think now, you know, is there evidence to support that that makes you healthier? I've heard stories. I know, you know, personally, I look at all my physician notes from about me to make sure that they're accurate and that I understood what the doctor said. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong there, but there's a lot in this. A lot of people are confusing parts of these rules that are being proposed because they're really touching on several things. So one of them that you mentioned that our former governor here in the state of Wisconsin, Tommy Thompson, was arguing against was that intellectual property. And so one part of these rules is to allow researchers, physicians and scientists, computer scientists, to share screenshots of technology that physicians and nurses use every day to say, hey, look at this screen, see how it's easy for someone to misunderstand this when they're entering information, right? Or it looks like it's this, but it's actually that. And if we could share these screens out, people would say, oh, that's bad. And, you know, a lot of the software companies don't want that. One could argue for two different reasons. One, the more obvious is, yeah, that's not great to have our poorly defined and designed screens out on some, you know, journal somewhere. So it's a little embarrassing and it's maybe bad for business. Another is, hey, we spent a lot of time developing that tool and a lot of software development time and intellectual property. And you're putting screenshots in there which our competitors will look at and then copy. And that's bad, right? And that's, I think, that's a valid concern. The first part is not, right? Hey, sorry that you're embarrassed that you have a bad, poorly designed screen. I think it makes sense that some would want to, you know, see those.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Incrementalist and News You Can Use. And today's episode is sponsored by HP, the leader in the world's most secure and manageable PCs. Learn more about HP's Healthcare Edition products at hp.com/go/healthcare/US, and be sure to follow the company on Twitter at HP. Coming back to our discussion, I think, you know, in fairness, I agree with you. I fully understand that issue of, you know, protection of intellectual product, intellectual property. My struggle with this screenshots is how else can you describe or help people understand that this is a problem? It reminds me a little bit, I know it's different, but it reminds me a little bit of the sort of security by obscurity methodology that we used to see many years ago, where people would say, if we don't tell anybody about all these bugs that leave you widely exposed through your operating system, then, you know, that's good news. And if you share it, you're going to be in trouble. And we've realized that that's not the appropriate way. So how can we share it without damaging and allowing for that? And I'm imagining that this is true for all vendors, not just the one that was highlighted in the Tommy Thompson discussion.
I understand where the developers are coming from, the vendors, mm-hmm. the software vendors, yet I'm with you in saying, I think the benefit far outweighs the harm. I also find it difficult to believe that if a competitor is out there and wants to see your screen, that they're going to have a hard time doing that, right? The top three or four EHRs are everywhere. Right. And all you need is a buddy who's got a cousin who's a doctor and say, hey, can I come and look at this thing? I just want to look over your shoulder. I'm just curious as to how that works, right? I'm not saying that it's a good thing, but it's so easy to do.
Right.
And so many people have access to the software that it's just hard to imagine that serious, you know, piracy would happen.
Increased based on the existing. Yeah. So I think all this really does, or potentially does, is legitimizes the access, whereas at least in those circumstances that you describe, people could turn around and say, well, if that's how you did it, you know, that was clearly wrong. I do respect it, but I think your point there is what I would hang my particular hat on here for the greater good. And, you know, in this particular instance, and it's not exclusively that, this is not about beating up on Epic in particular. I think this applies to Cerner, although, you know, maybe they don't have a governor that's trying to, you know, advocate on their behalf, albeit I think inelegantly was my view. That's just how it came across.
I read it and I actually was smiling because I thought, oh boy, this is, he's, you know, that's a small part of this whole picture. And, you know, in both Epic and Cerner's defense, I have personally been involved in publishing screenshots of theirs, mm-hmm. not being, you know, it wasn't for my articles, but I was helping other physicians who were publishing. Right. And all that they asked was, ask us, just ask us so we know what you're doing and where it's going right. and why you're publishing it.
And can I ask a direct question there? In those yeah. instances, did they outright reject? What was the result? How did that go?
It was always approved.
So
there you go. You know, they, but they do, you know, I could imagine that, I mean, you know, they ask, what are you trying to show?
Right.
Because if for instance, and again, I'll speak specifically about one just happened to me within the last 3 or 4 months, you know, we had proposed this screenshot of the entire screen and they said, oh, okay, you're highlighting this particular aspect. Why don't you just focus in on this third? Right. Meaning, because everything else was really just super mm-hmm. peripheral to the conversation, right. yeah. which actually A, probably improved the right. illustration, and B, obscured some of their intellectual property in air quotes that didn't need to be seen. So again, it would be hard, it would be awkward for them to say, no, we don't want that because that makes us look bad. Now, I've never gotten to that point. Like, I've never been involved in requesting it, but I think they'd be hard pressed to say no. That said, you know, it is completely different than, so, you know, since we're naming names, Epic sued a consulting company from India for a lot of money and won. I think it's now at about $400 million that they, mm-hmm. they won, which they haven't seen a dime of. But because that, they had a consultant who kind of snuck into the back area, the more technical area, and just downloaded tens of thousands of pages
right.
of instructions about how to use the software
right.
and because they were clearly making a competitor. Now that completely wrong, but the risk of that for people who want to show usability examples
right.
seems to me right. a stretch. So I think it's going to happen. What's more interesting to me is not can we have screenshots, but another part of the rules is can we open up our data? Can a patient say, I want this app. I give permission to this company to go into my data from this hospital and that hospital and take these things. And is that okay?
Right.
And the immediate answer is, of course, it's your data. Why would it not be okay? But when you think about it more closely, there are some issues there. Not that you shouldn't have the data, but should this third party have the data? You've allowed it, but everyone knows, I know you read every end user licensing agreement, every EULA.
Oh, absolutely.
Says, click here, read through these pages and pages of legalese, and then click here to say that you approve.
I actually use an AI to read it, but go on.
There you go, because you're ahead. I'm behind, so I just scroll all the way down and click accept. So the point is that there undoubtedly, if we start really opening up which these rules would allow, if we start making it so that pretty much anyone, as long as they say they've gotten your permission, which means that A, they've explained what they're going to use the data for, how long they're going to hold it, who they're going to sell it to, if anyone, that data is now out. It's free. It's free ranging, and you're never going to get it back. And maybe you made a decision, maybe you made a bad decision by allowing that company to have access to your data. But if there are rules that say, hey, anyone that, you know, has these three boxes checked and technically securely can get the data out, they can get your data from Mayo Clinic and from Cleveland Clinic and from NYU and from anywhere else where you have data, and then it's theirs. And I suspect that these hospitals and health systems are a little concerned that someone's going to come back to them and say, hey, there was a big dump of data and all that patient data that from Mayo Clinic is there. How'd that get
there?
It
reminds me a lot of the, my analogy is around all of this, the data aggregators that are now suddenly showing up of names of companies that people have never heard of with millions and millions of records that have been breached. And essentially they've pulled all this data from supermarkets, from credit card companies, they've tied it all together and they have this incredible portfolio that essentially ties you to you and all of this other stuff. And I think what you're saying is that that's a potential risk with this. If we have medical data aggregators, and nobody wants that, we should have learned from the consumer information. We don't want to tie it also to our cancer records and so forth. So, you know, fair comment. I think, you know, I hear you, and I'm a little bit less, you know, gung-ho for all-out war, as it were, and, you know, give me my damn data approach, which I don't think is the right approach anyway. I think we have to be sort of thoughtful about it. That's great. We got time, I think, for one more topic. So let's talk about this data-driven physician report that came out from Stanford that's suggesting that new doctors are being trained and prepared for this new world of digital information. And I read it, saw it. It came from, or it was highlighted in one of the documents that I read on a regular basis from the Healthy Thinker. And my reaction was, on what planet does any medical student have even one iota of time to dedicate to new activities, given that in the short period of time since I went through medical school, the amount of data that they've crammed in has just exploded beyond recognition. To be clear, when I learned, in fact, when I took finals, AIDS was still a question mark over causation and HIV or HTLV-3, as it was, or elements of it. You know, the explosion of data and what they're cramming in, and I'm living vicariously this whole experience. I just don't understand what's happening. You think that's going on? We think you've got doctors that are prepared for this whole digital world?
It's hard to imagine. I'm with you. Some of these were surveys of large numbers of doctors. And,
right.
You know, I'm looking at one right now that says nearly half of all physicians and 3/4 of all medical students are seeking out additional training to better prepare themselves for innovations in healthcare. And they're talking about advanced statistics, genetic counseling, population health, and coding. I have not met these doctors. Now, and as I mentioned to you a little bit before we started recording, like, it's hard for me to get physicians to come and spend a half an hour. When I say hard, I mean impossible. You know, spend a half an hour or 45 minutes learning to more effectively use the electronic health record, which is a tool that they may not want, but that they use all day long, right? And so, and there are ways of using it better. And people, and I understand, you know, they don't have time, and I understand that they don't have time, which makes me wonder, as it did you, who are these physicians? 47% of whom said that, you know, they're pursuing advanced education.
That's one in two. Every other doctor, who are they surveying?
I don't know. I think it's kind of like, you know, you've seen polls where, you know, people are going to vote for candidate X and then candidate Y just goes and wins.
We dived into politics right there.
Yeah. Well, but these are surveys which are like polls, and I don't know. I think it's a great idea. I think physicians are drowning in data. They're
right,
drowning in information. We're throwing all this at them, and they feel and may be actually responsible for everything that ever happened to this patient. So, I get that people would want to find ways of better dealing with the just tremendous amounts of information that's out there, but I don't see them taking classes. It would be great, though.
Well, I mean, to be clear, I don't think that's what you really mean. I think what you're saying is, it's not that they don't want to. I think for the vast majority, these are exciting opportunities. I'm sure there are some holdouts that, you know, maybe consider it not. I think the issue is they don't have the time available to be able to do this, given
Agreed.
The, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think people are interested, but it's just, everyone is working harder than they used to. And
right. And there's a mandate for what's covered. I mean, essentially, I think it's laid out in pretty clear detail based on my experiences with the Dell Medical School. And they had, you know, aspirations to sort of include things and have done the best that they can, but they still have to get all of the stuff that's required to be taught. How do you feel? Okay, add another year. I'm sure people would be really excited about that. Another 50,000 down on the line.
I was going to say, since we're both done with our training, then I think an extra year makes complete sense.
Oh, you're so mean. I can't believe you said that. I would never say that, especially as I've
another
got somebody
2 years, Dr. Nick. another two.
Right, that's it. We're done. All right, so we've run out of time as usual, so just remains for me to thank you as always. It's always a pleasure to catch up and talk about what's going on. Thanks, Greg.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining me. This is Dr. Nick, the incrementalist and a whiskey librarian. I want to thank HP for sponsoring today's episode. You can learn more about HP and their healthcare edition products that were designed with clinicians in mind to streamline patient care and optimize clinical workflows at hp.com/go/healthcare/US.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.